Now, it's hard to turn on the radio or television now and not to be told to reduce your carbon footprint or be more green and things like that. So that's not the message of this show, though, because we want to talk about not the problem of climate change, but the solution. And on the line now is Margaret Linen. She works for Climos, which is a company based in the United States. Hello, Margaret.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Your plan is to try to lock away CO2 and solve the problem of climate change by encouraging the oceans to soak up more of it. How does it work?
Well, a few years ago, in studying what controlled the biological productivity of the oceans, scientists found that most of the open ocean, far away from land, was limited, actually, by iron. And iron is very insoluble, so iron from rivers precipitates out close to shore. Far away from land, the iron often comes from dust storms that move out far over the sea and then fall into the water. So they did both experiments in the laboratory and observations at sea, and then over the last 20 years, they've done a set of a dozen experiments at sea spreading fairly soluble iron, iron sulfate, to see what happened. And they found in every case that there were very, very big phytoplankton blooms. Phytoplankton are the small microscopic plants of the sea. So when the phytoplankton bloom, they make organic carbon out of water and CO2 from the atmosphere. Some of that organic carbon is eaten or decomposes close to the surface, so nothing happens to it. But some of it sinks much deeper into the ocean, where it's protected from exchange with the atmosphere. So the big question is, how much of that is sequestered? And that's what the current round of scientific experiments that are proposed are designed to answer.
So what you're saying is that the dead bugs which fall to the bottom of the sea will end up locking away carbon in a form where it won't resurface in the atmosphere. And so in that respect, it's almost like turning it back into coal.
Well, yes. The sequestration is not as long-term as turning it back into coal. It's sequestered for periods of 100 to 1,000 years rather than up to millions of years like coal.
So why are you arguing then, Margaret, this is a way of sort of buying us time rather than solving the problem of climate change? It locks the CO2 into a position where it can't cause trouble while we sort ourselves out and get our house in order.
That's exactly right. And not only that, it's not a silver bullet. This will not solve the CO2 problem, but it can help in the same way that every other technology and approach that is being discussed can help with the problem.
Doesn't sound particularly environmentally friendly, though. There must be some possible unforeseen effects of scattering large amounts of iron sulfate, that's quite acidic in itself, onto the surface of the ocean to then create a bloom or a massive growth or a surge in the growth of just one species of marine organisms. There must be knock-on effects of that.
Well, several things. First of all, it doesn't just stimulate one species. It stimulates a whole set of species with time. And we know that both from looking at how this happens naturally. Remember, all of that, those very large quantities of iron go out onto the ocean all of the time, and that's what actually stimulates the blooms. But that set of questions about what are the consequences for the chemistry and the biology of the ocean are very important. And, of course, the first set of questions is, does this work? Does it really sequester CO2? Previous experiments weren't well designed to answer that question, and so that suggests a new set. And then if it does sequester CO2, then we need to know about the consequences for chemistry and biology, and what do they tell us about the limits to which this could and should be used to draw down CO2. So you're obviously going to have to balance that against the problem of CO2 in the atmosphere, what it does in terms of acidification of the ocean and so forth.
Now, Margaret, you say that previous tests weren't really kind of conclusive as to the whether or not this was going to work. And are you looking at trying to answer that question now? And what are you doing to try and kind of get to that answer?
Well, our company is trying to bring private funding sources to the ocean science community to enable them to answer the questions. What they want to do is have a set of larger area experiments so that they would fertilize areas of the ocean about 100 by 100 kilometers. They want to stay much longer to really observe this whole sequence of activities in the bloom rather than just say, oh yes, phytoplankton bloomed. Then they also want to bring new state-of-the-art sampling gear to the the ocean. We didn't have a lot of the remotely robotic autonomous vehicles during the time that the experiments were done. And finally, they want to do a lot more modeling to understand how long the CO2 will remain in the ocean and how soon the ocean will re-equilibrate and pull CO2 out of the atmosphere.
Now, Margaret, Climos is a company, so you must have a business model. How do you expect to make money from this?
Well, if carbon is sequestered, and that has to be demonstrated in a rigorous fashion with measurements, with external observers, with very open data, then the carbon that is sequestered can be sold as carbon offsets on the voluntary market for voluntary carbon market.
Okay, thank you, Margaret. So this seems like a very good opportunity to bring in Chris Vivian. He's from CFAS. That's the Centre for Environment, Fisheries and Aquaculture Science. I guess that makes you sort of the oceanographic equivalent of DEFRA, Chris. How do you react to what Margaret's saying?
Hello, Margaret. Good to hear from you. Margaret's quite right in many aspects that we are still don't know enough about exactly what happens in these situations. There's a large degree of uncertainty and a lot of issues to be resolved. The some of the issues you mentioned, we just don't have answers to at the moment, but the experiments that Margaret's talk about should help to identify those.
So what are the big things? What are the big worries? So you, as someone who's worried about the
ocean? Well, some of the issues that have been raised are, will we change the phytoplankton community in the oceans, for example, by doing repeated experiments of this type? Will we, through putting a lot more organic matter deeper into the water, will we change the oxygen conditions there, reduce the oxygen? Will we change pH? Will we create additional other gases which may have global warming potential? There's some concerns being raised with nitrous
CO2
oxide.
CO2 goes down, comes up as something
could
different.
Could be nitrous
even worse.
Oxide yep. or methane, for example, can be generated by plankton blooms. We don't know enough about those yet to understand whether they are significant. They may be, they may not be.
Let's see if Margaret can offer us any reassurance on that score. What do you think, Margaret?
Well, we totally agree with Chris that those are the issues about, but he raised some that have to do with how much CO2 you can sequester and also what the side effects are in terms of other greenhouse gases, and then those other questions about biology and chemistry. We certainly know that you do change the oxygen conditions in the ocean because that CO2 that falls deep into the ocean is it's not CO2, it's organic carbon that falls deep into the ocean, and it is changed by combination with oxygen into bicarbonate. So the question is that we need these experiments in order to answer those questions. And so we think that this first phase has to be very carefully designed in order to answer both the sequestration questions and the biology and chemistry effect questions.
So Helen, as a marine biologist, how does this sit with you? Are you worried? Because we've seen umpteen examples of where if you change one species quite dramatically, you get knock-on effects with other things. We've had huge plagues of jellyfish, for example, because we've removed all the big fish that would have eaten the jellyfish. So what do you think the implications of this could be?
I think you're quite right. I think, to be honest, the implications are potentially huge and we really don't understand them yet. That's the problem with the oceans. They can be so complex, the interactions between different groups of animals and plants. So predicting that's going to be really difficult. You could generally take an approach of you are messing with something that we don't understand, so why do that? But maybe because what we're going to achieve will be important enough to do that. But I think we just don't know. That's the problem.
It's not very reassuring, Chris.
Well, at the moment, I think it's far too early to judge whether this could be a viable mechanism to offset climate change any degree. And certainly the estimates that have been made are that it's probably could only be a relatively minor one. That's not to say lots of minor ones might not add up and, of course, be useful if they are otherwise acceptable. So one could not rule it out at the moment, but I think it's far too early to say that it would be a viable option right now.
What do you think are better options? If this is not going to be something which actually has legs, what do you think we should be putting our resources into?
If we look at what's happening now in a number of countries, various parts of the world, things like carbon capture and storage in subgeological structures is being pushed quite hard by the UK and other governments around the world because they believe there's a lot of capacity for that. Now, some of these things will take quite a bit of time to bring into effect, of course, and there are that's probably the biggest one, and it has the biggest capacity, we think. But it will require a lot of money to get it worked up into a viable and a practical option.
And I know we said we weren't going to talk about the problems of climate change, but I just wondered what maybe, Chris, what you think about how much this really kind of takes people's minds off the problem of creating carbon dioxide in the first place. And does this kind of make us feel a bit better? If there's an option to kind of mop it up, then we don't have to worry about creating it in the first place.
Well, that is certainly a concern that's been raised by NGOs in some of the international discussions. They feel there is a danger that some countries will see this as a way to avoid doing anything. It's certainly a concern. Certainly governments, I think, view it as just as one means of trying to help deal with the problem. We've got to, in their view, I think, apply a portfolio of all sorts of options, including all of the sort of things we've talked about for energy efficiency and so on, renewables, etc., etc. We need to hit it with everything, really, to try and address the problem.
Because the oceans have suffered quite badly because of the effects of global warming, and they continue to do so. The models predict that they will. The oceans will become more acidic, for example.
You're exactly right. That is certainly probably one of the major effects of global climate change that wasn't fully appreciated early on, is that over a long term, we're going to make the oceans distinctly more acid. So we are threatening, for example, the existence of corals in the world ocean, possibly over something like 100 years. There'll be great danger. We'll have hardly any corals left in surface waters because the oceans will be too acidic.
And quickly, Margaret, when do you see actually the strategy for getting this actually tested and then perhaps into a phase where you're selling carbon credits by seeding the ocean in the way you describe actually working?
Well, I think that we're planning for the first experiment that we would give funding to the oceanographic community to do probably in about a year. I anticipate that we're probably looking at a period of a few years, 3 to 5 years of experimentation to answer the questions that you've raised and that Chris has raised to see whether this technique is effective, and if so, to what degree should it be used. And I think that one of the very attractive things about it, of course, is that it does actually remove CO2 from the atmosphere, not just limit emissions. And Chris raised the issue of acidification, and it's a very serious one. And we're stuck with that as long as there is all of this excess CO2 in the atmosphere. So, again, this technique wouldn't remove all of it, but it could help.
Chris?
Yes, indeed. I think that's probably correct. Certainly, there's a recent publication in the journal Science by 16 leading scientists in this area of ocean iron fertilisation who've identified a series of issues that need to be addressed before they can, we think it could be justifiable if they're all resolved satisfactorily. And it would seem to me that they are going to take a significant amount of time to resolve. I couldn't make a judgment of how long, but I would certainly think, I'd be surprised if it was less than 5 years, put it that way, be my personal judgment, but that's just my personal view.
Thank you very much. That's Chris Vivian. He's from CFAS, the Centre for Environment, Fisheries and Aquaculture Science, and also Margaret Leinen, who is from Climos. This is The Naked Scientists with Dr. Chris and Dr. Helen. We're talking this week about solutions to the problem of climate change. In a second, we'll learn how old coal mines and even coal that can't be accessed by mining could provide a useful place to stuff some of that excess CO2. We'll be hearing about that, and also how lava could also be a useful repository. You can pump the CO2 down into lava and it turns literally into stone. If you want to participate in our discussion, you can email us, chris@thenakedscientist.com.
The Naked Scientist Podcast, brought to you by thenakedscientist.com.